There they experienced the sweaty thrill of 120-degree weather in a car with no air conditioning, and learned to love pit stops at Carl's Jr. burger joints, where they spent hours recuperating in the cold. The trip provided plenty of time for your typical 20-something hijinks and raging capitalist daydreaming. The web had just started to become accessible to the public, thanks to the rise of directory sites like Yahoo and tools like Netscape's browser. The brothers were tuned in to the Internet and thought they might like to start a company together doing something on the web. From California to Colorado, Wyoming, South Dakota, and Illinois, they took turns driving, brainstorming, and talking shit before heading back east to get Musk to school that fall. The best idea to arise from the journey was an online network for doctors. This wasn't meant to be something as ambitious as electronic health records, but more of a system for physicians to exchange information and collaborate. It seemed like the medical industry was one that could be disrupted, Kimball said. I went to work on a business plan and the sales and marketing side of it later, but it didn't fly. We didn't love it. Musk had spent the earlier part of that summer in Silicon Valley, holding down a pair of internships. By day, he worked at Pinnacle Research Institute. Based in Los Gatos, Pinnacle was a much ballyhooed startup, with a team of scientists exploring ways in which ultracapacitors could be used as a revolutionary fuel source in electric and hybrid vehicles. The work also veered, at least conceptually, into more bizarre territory. Musk could talk at length about how ultracapacitors might be used to build laser-based sidearms in the tradition of Star Wars and just about any other futuristic film. The laser guns would release rounds of enormous energy, and then the shooter would replace an ultracapacitor at the base of the gun, much like swapping out a clip of bullets, and start blasting away again. Ultracapacitors also looked promising as the power supplies for missiles. They were much more resilient than batteries under the mechanical stresses of a launch, and would hold a more consistent charge over long periods of time. Musk fell in love with the work at Pinnacle, and began using it as the basis for some of his business plan experiments at Penn and for his industrialist fantasies. In the evenings, Musk headed to Rocket Science Games, a startup based in Palo Alto that wanted to create the most advanced video games ever made by moving them off cartridges and onto CDs that could hold more information. The CDs would, in theory, allow them to bring Hollywood-style storytelling and production quality to the games. A team of budding all-stars who were a mix of engineers and film people was assembled to pull off the work. Tony Fadell, who would later drive much of the development of both the iPod and iPhone at Apple, worked at Rocket Science, as did the guys who developed the QuickTime multimedia software for Apple. They also had people who worked on the original Star Wars effects at Industrial Light and Magic, and some who did games at LucasArts Entertainment. Rocket Science gave Musk a flavor for what Silicon Valley had to offer, both from a talent and culture perspective. There were people working at the office 24 hours a day, and they didn't think it at all odd that Musk would turn up around 5 p.m. every evening to start his second job.
"We brought him in to write some very menial low-level code," said Peter Barrett, an Australian engineer who helped start the company. "He was completely unflappable. After a short while, I don't think anyone was giving him any direction, and he ended up making what he wanted to make."
Specifically, Musk had been asked to write the drivers that would let joysticks and mice communicate with various computers and games. Drivers are the same types of annoying files that you have to install to get a printer or camera working with a home computer. True grunt work. A self-taught programmer, Musk fancied himself quite good at coding and assigned himself to more ambitious jobs. "I was basically trying to figure out how you could multitask stuff, so you could read video from a CD while running a game at the same time," Musk said. "At the time, you could do one or the other. It was this complicated bit of assembly programming." Complicated indeed. Musk had to issue commands that spoke directly to a computer's main microprocessor and fiddled with the most basic functions that made the machine work. Bruce Leak, the former lead engineer behind Apple's QuickTime, had overseen the hiring of Musk and marveled at his ability to pull all-nighters.
"He had boundless energy," Leak said.
"Kids these days have no idea about hardware or how stuff works, but he had a PC hacker background and was not afraid to just go figure things out." Musk found in Silicon Valley a wealth of the opportunity he'd been seeking and a place equal to his ambitions. He would return 2 summers in a row and then bolt west permanently after graduating with dual degrees from Penn. He initially intended to pursue a doctorate in materials science and physics at Stanford and to advance the work he'd done at Pinnacle on ultracapacitors. As the story goes, Musk dropped out of Stanford after 2 days, finding the Internet's call irresistible. He talked Kimball into moving to Silicon Valley as well, so they could conquer the web together. The first inklings of a viable Internet business had come to Musk during his internships. A salesperson from the Yellow Pages had come into one of the startup offices. He tried to sell the idea of an online listing to complement the regular listing a company would have in the big, fat Yellow Pages book. The salesman struggled with his pitch and clearly had little grasp of what the Internet actually was or how someone would find a business on it. The flimsy pitch got Musk thinking, and he reached out to Kimball, talking up the idea of helping businesses get online for the first time. Elon said, "These guys don't know what they're talking about. Maybe this is something we can do," Kimball said. This was 1995, and the brothers were about to form Global Link Information Network, a startup that would eventually be renamed as Zip2. For details on the controversy surrounding Zip2's founding and Musk's academic record, listen to Appendix 1. The Zip2 idea was ingenious. Few small businesses in 1995 understood the ramifications of the Internet. They had little idea how to get on it and didn't really see the value in creating a website for their business or even in having a Yellow Pages-like listing online. Musk and his brother hoped to convince restaurants, clothing shops, hairdressers, and the like that the time had come for them to make their presence known to the web-surfing public. Zip2 would create a searchable directory of businesses and tie this into maps. Musk often explained the concept through pizza, saying that everyone deserved the right to know the location of their closest pizza parlor and the turn-by-turn directions to get there. This may seem obvious today. Think Yelp meets Google Maps. But back then, not even stoners had dreamed up such a service. The Musk brothers brought Zip2 to life at 430 Sherman Avenue in Palo Alto. They rented a studio apartment-sized office, 20 feet by 30 feet, and acquired some basic furniture. The 3-story building had its quirks. There were no elevators, and the toilets often backed up. "It was literally a shitty place to work," said an early employee. To get a fast Internet connection, Musk struck a deal with Ray Girouard, an entrepreneur who ran an Internet service provider operation from the floor below the Zip2 offices. According to Girouard, Musk drilled a hole in the drywall near the Zip2 door and then strung an Ethernet cable down the stairwell to the ISP. "They were slow to pay a couple of times, but never stiffed me on the bill," Girouard said. Musk did all of the original coding behind the service himself, while the more amiable Kimball looked to ramp up the door-to-door sales operation. Musk had acquired a cheap license to a database of business listings in the Bay Area that would give a business's name and its address. He then contacted Navtech, a company that had spent hundreds of millions of dollars to create digital maps and directions that could be used in early GPS navigation-style devices, and struck a masterful bargain. "We called them up, and they gave us the technology for free," said Kimball. Musk merged the 2 databases together to get a rudimentary system up and running. Over time, Zip2's engineers had to augment this initial data haul with more maps to cover areas outside of major metropolitan areas, and to build custom turn-by-turn directions that would look good and work well on a home computer. Errol Musk gave his sons $28,000 to help them through this period. But they were more or less broke after getting the office space, licensing software, and buying some equipment. For the first 3 months of Zip2's life, Musk and his brother lived at the office. They had a small closet where they kept their clothes and would shower at the YMCA. "Sometimes we ate four meals a day at Jack in the Box," Kimball said. "It was open 24 hours, which suited our work schedule. I got a smoothie one time, and there was something in it. I just pulled it out and kept drinking. I haven't been able to eat there since, but I can still recite their menu." Next, the brothers rented a two-bedroom apartment. They didn't have the money or the inclination to get furniture, so there were just a couple of mattresses on the floor. Musk somehow managed to convince a young South Korean engineer to come work at Zip2 as an intern in exchange for room and board. "This poor kid thought he was coming over for a job at a big company," Kimball said. "He ended up living with us and had no idea what he was getting into." One day, the intern drove the Musk's battered BMW 320i to work, and a wheel came off en route. The axle dug into the street at the intersection of Page Mill Road and El Camino Real, and the groove it carved out remained visible for years. Zip2 may have been a go-go internet enterprise aimed at the information age, but getting it off the ground required old-fashioned door-to-door salesmanship. Businesses needed to be persuaded of the web's benefits and charmed into paying for the unknown. In late 1995, the Musk brothers began making their first hires and assembling a motley sales team. Jeff Heilman, a free-spirited 20-year-old trying to figure out what to do with his life, arrived as one of Zip2's first recruits. He'd been watching TV late one night with his dad and seen a web address printed at the bottom of the screen during a commercial. "It was for something.com," Heilman said. "I remember sitting there and asking my dad what we were looking at. He said he didn't know either. That's when I realized I had to go find me some internet." Heilman spent a couple of weeks trying to chat up people who could explain the internet to him, and then stumbled on a 2x2-inch Zip2 job listing in the San Jose Mercury News. "Internet sales apply here," it read, and Heilman got the gig. A handful of other salespeople joined him and worked for commissions. Musk never seemed to leave the office. He slept, not unlike a dog, on a beanbag next to his desk. "Almost every day I'd come in at 7:30 or 8 a.m., and he'd be asleep right there on that bag," Heilman said. "Maybe he showered on the weekends, I don't know." Musk asked those first employees of Zip2 to give him a kick when they arrived, and he'd wake up and get back to work. While Musk did his possessed coder thing, Kimball became the rah-rah sales leader. Kimball was the eternal optimist, and he was very, very uplifting, Heilman said. "I had never met anyone quite like him." Kimball sent Heilman to the high-end Stanford Shopping Mall and University Avenue, the main drag in Palo Alto, to coax retailers into signing up with Zip2, explaining that a sponsored listing would send a company to the top of search results. The big problem, of course, was that no one was buying. Week after week, Heilman knocked on doors and returned to the office with very little to report in the way of good news. The nicest responses came from the people who told Heilman that advertising on the internet sounded like the dumbest thing they had ever heard of. Most often, the shop owners just told Heilman to leave and stop bothering them. When lunchtime came around, the Musks would reach into a cigar box where they kept some cash, take Heilman out, and get the depressing status reports on the sales. Craig Moore, another early employee, gave up his job selling real estate to hawk Zip2 service. He decided to court auto dealerships because they usually spent lots of money on advertising. He told them about Zip2's main website, www.totalinfo.com, and tried to convince them that demand was high to get a listing like www.totalinfo.com/Toyota of Silicon Valley.
The service did not always work when Moore demonstrated it, or it would load very slowly, as was common back then. This forced him to talk the customers into imagining Zip2's potential. "One day I came back with about $900 in checks," Moore said. "I walked into the office and asked the guys what they wanted me to do with the money." Elon stopped pounding his keyboard, leaned out from behind his monitor, and said, "No way! You've got money!" What kept the employees' spirits up were the continuous improvements Musk made with the Zip2 software. The service had morphed from a proof of concept to an actual product that could be used and demoed. Ever marketing savvy, the Musk brothers tried to make their web service seem more important by giving it an imposing physical body. Musk built a huge case around a standard PC and lugged the unit onto a base with wheels. When prospective investors would come by, Musk would put on a show and roll this massive machine out so that it appeared like Zip2 ran inside of a mini supercomputer. "The investors thought that was impressive," Kimball said. Heilman also noticed that the investors bought into Musk's slavish devotion to the company. Even then, as essentially a college kid with zits, Elon had this drive that this thing, whatever it was, had to get done, and that if he didn't do it, he'd miss his shot, Heilman said. I think that's what the VCs saw, that he was willing to stake his existence on building out this platform. Musk actually said as much to one venture capitalist, informing him, "My mentality is that of a samurai. I would rather commit seppuku than fail." Early on in the Zip2 venture, Musk acquired an important confidant who tempered some of these more dramatic impulses. Greg Currie, a Canadian businessman in his mid-30s, had met the Musks in Toronto and bought into the early Zip2 brainstorming. The boys had showed up at his door one morning to inform Currie that they intended to head to California to give the business a shot. Still in his red bathrobe, Currie went back into the house, dug around for a couple of minutes, and came back with a wad of $6,000. In early 1996, he moved to California and joined Zip2 as a co-founder. Currie, who had done a number of real estate deals in the past and had actual business experience and skills at reading people, served as the adult supervision at Zip2. The Canadian had a knack for calming Musk and ended up becoming something of a mentor. "Really smart people sometimes don't understand that not everyone can keep up with them or go as fast," said Derek Prudian, a venture capitalist who had become Zip2's chief executive officer. "Greg is one of the few people that Elon would listen to and had a way of putting things in context for him." Currie also used to referee fistfights between Elon and Kimball in the middle of the office. "I don't get in fights with anyone else, but Elon and I don't have the ability to reconcile a vision other than our own," Kimball said. During a particularly nasty scrap over a business decision, Elon ripped some skin off his fist and had to go get a tetanus shot. Currie put an end to the fights after that. Currie died of a heart attack in 2012 at the age of 51, having made a fortune investing in Musk's companies. Musk attended his funeral. "We owe him a lot," said Kimball. In early 1996, Zip2 underwent a massive change. The venture capital firm Moore David Au Ventures had caught wind of a couple of South African boys trying to make a yellow pages for the Internet and met with the brothers. Musk, while raw in his presentation skills, pitched the company well enough, and the investors came away impressed with his energy. Moore David Au invested $3 million into the company. The Musk brothers were not the most aggressive businessmen at this point. I remember from their business plan that they were originally asking for a $10,000 investment for 25% of their company, said Steve Jurvetson, the venture capitalist. "That is a cheap deal." When I heard about the $3 million investment, I wondered if Moore David Au had actually read the business plan. Somehow, the brothers ended up raising a normal venture round. With these funds in hand, the company officially changed its name from Global Link to Zip2. The idea being Zip2 here, Zip2 there. Moved to a larger office at 390 Cambridge Avenue in Palo Alto and began hiring talented engineers. Zip2 also shifted its business strategy. At the time, the company had built one of the best direction systems on the web. Zip2 would advance this technology and take it from focusing just on the Bay Area to having a national scope. The company's main focus, however, would be an altogether new play. Instead of selling its service door-to-door, Zip2 would create a software package that could be sold to newspapers, which would in turn build their own directories for real estate, auto dealers, and classifieds. The newspapers were late understanding how the Internet would impact their businesses, and Zip2's software would give them a quick way of getting online without needing to develop all their own technology from scratch. For its part, Zip2 could chase bigger prey and get a cut of a nationwide network of listings. The transition of the business model and the company's makeup would be a seminal moment in Musk's life. The venture capitalists pushed Musk into the role of chief technology officer and hired Rich Sorkin as the company's CEO. Sorkin had worked at Creative Labs, a maker of audio equipment, and run the business development group at the company, where he steered a number of investments in Internet startups. Zip2's investors saw him as experienced and clued into the web. While Musk agreed to the arrangement, he came to resent giving up control of Zip2. "Probably the biggest regret the whole time I worked with him was that he had made a deal with the devil with Moore Davidow," said Jim Ambrus, the vice president of engineering at Zip2. "Elon didn't have any operational responsibilities, and he wanted to be CEO. Ambrus had worked at Hewlett-Packard Labs and Silicon Graphics, Inc., and exemplified the high-caliber talent Zip2 brought on after the first wave of money arrived. Silicon Graphics, a maker of high-end computers beloved by Hollywood, was the flashiest company of its day and had hoarded the elite geeks of Silicon Valley. And yet Ambrus used the promise of Internet riches to poach a team of SGI's smartest engineers over to Zip2. "Our attorneys got a letter from SGI saying that we were cherry-picking the very best guys," Ambrus said. Elon thought that was fantastic. While Musk had excelled as a self-taught coder, his skills weren't nearly as polished as those of the new hires. They took one look at Zip2's code and began rewriting the vast majority of the software. Musk bristled at some of their changes, but the computer scientists needed just a fraction of the lines of code that Musk used to get their jobs done. They had a knack for dividing software projects into chunks that could be altered and refined, whereas Musk fell into the classic self-taught coder trap of writing what developers call hairballs, big monolithic hunks of code that could go berserk for mysterious reasons. The engineers also brought a more refined working structure and realistic deadlines to the engineering group. This was a welcome change from Musk's approach, which had been to set overly optimistic deadlines and then try to get engineers to work nonstop for days on end to meet the goals. If you asked Elon how long it would take to do something, there was never anything in his mind that would take more than an hour, Ambrus said. "We came to interpret an hour as really taking a day or two. And if Elon ever did say something would take a day, we allowed for a week or 2 weeks." Starting Zip2 and watching it grow imbued Musk with self-confidence. Terence Benne, one of Musk's high school friends, came to California for a visit and noticed the change in Musk's character right away. He watched Musk confront a nasty landlord who had been giving his mother, who was renting an apartment in town, a hard time. He said, "If you're going to bully someone, bully me." It was startling to see him take over the situation. The last time I'd seen him, he was this geeky, awkward kid who would sometimes lose his temper. He was the kid you would pick on to get a response. Now he was confident and in control.
Musk also began consciously trying to manage his criticism of others.
Elon is not someone who would say, "I feel you, I see your point of view," said Justine. Because he doesn't have that "I feel you" dimension, there were things that seemed obvious to other people that weren't obvious to him. He had to learn that a 20-something-year-old shouldn't really shoot down the plans of older senior people and point out everything wrong with them. He learned to modify his behavior in certain ways. I just think he comes at the world through strategy and intellect.
The personality tweaks worked with varying degrees of success. Musk still tended to drive the young engineers mad with his work demands and blunt criticism. I remember being in a meeting once brainstorming about a new product, a new car site, said Doris Downs, the creative director at Zip2. Someone complained about a technical change that we wanted being impossible. Elon turned and said, "I don't really give a damn what you think," and walked out of the meeting. For Elon, the word "no" does not exist, and he expects that attitude from everyone around him. Periodically, Musk let loose on the more senior executives as well.
You would see people come out of the meetings with this disgusted look on their face, Moore, the salesman, said. You don't get to where Elon is now by always being a nice guy, and he was just so driven and sure of himself.
As Musk tried to come to terms with the changes the investors had inflicted on Zip2, he did enjoy some of the perks of having big money backing. The financiers helped the Musk brothers with their visas. They also gave them $30,000 each to buy cars. Musk and Kimball had traded in their dilapidated BMW for a dilapidated sedan that they spray-painted with polka dots. Kimball upgraded from that to a BMW 3 Series, and Musk bought a Jaguar E-Type. It kept breaking down and would arrive at the office on a flatbed, Kimball said. But Elon always thought big. Musk also got to show off the new office to his mother, May, and Justine. May sometimes sat in on meetings and came up with the idea of adding a reverse directions button on the Zip2 maps, which let people flip around their journeys and ended up becoming a popular feature on all mapping services. As a bonding exercise one weekend, Musk, Ambrose, a few other employees and friends took off for a bike ride through the Saratoga Gap Trail in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Most of the riders had been training and were accustomed to strenuous sessions and the summer's heat. They set up the mountains at a furious pace. After an hour, Russ Rive, Musk's cousin, reached the top and proceeded to vomit. Right behind him were the rest of the cyclists. Then, 15 minutes later, Musk became visible to the group. His face had turned purple, and sweat poured out of him, and he made it to the top. I always think back to that ride. He wasn't close to being in the condition needed for it, Ambrose said. Anyone else would have quit or walked up their bike. As I watched him climb that final 100 feet with suffering all over his face, I thought, that's Elon. Do or die, but don't give up. Musk continued to be a ball of energy around the office as well. Ahead of visits by venture capitalists and other investors, Musk would rally the troops and instruct them all to get on the phone to create a buzzy atmosphere. He also formed a video game team to participate in competitions around Quake, a first-person shooter game. We competed in one of the first nationwide tournaments, Musk said. We came in second, and we would have come in first, but one of our top players' machine crashed because he had pushed his graphics card too hard. We won a few $1,000s. Zip2 had remarkable success courting newspapers. The New York Times, Knight Ridder, Hearst Corporation, and other media properties signed up to its service. Some of these companies contributed $50 million in additional funding for Zip2. Services like Craigslist, with its free online classifieds, had just started to appear, and the newspapers needed some course of action. The newspapers knew they were in trouble with the Internet, and the idea was to sign up as many of them as possible, Ambrose said. They wanted classifieds and listings for real estate, automotive, and entertainment,
and could use us as a platform for all these online services. Zip2 acquired a trademark for its "We Power the Press" slogan, and the influx of cash kept Zip2 growing fast. Company headquarters were soon so crowded that one desk ended up directly in front of the women's bathroom. In 1997, Zip2 moved into flashier, more spacious digs at 444 Castro Street in Mountain View. It irritated Musk that Zip2 had become a behind-the-scenes player to the newspapers. He believed the company could offer interesting services directly to consumers and encourage the purchase of the domain name city.com with the hopes of turning it into a consumer destination. But the lure of the media company's money kept Sorkin and the board on a conservative path, and they decided to worry about a consumer push down the road. In April 1998, Zip2 announced a blockbuster move to double down on its strategy. It would merge with its main competitor, CitySearch, in a deal valued at around $300 million. The new company would retain the CitySearch name, while Sorkin would head up the venture. On paper, the union looked very much like a merger of equals. CitySearch had built up an extensive set of directories for cities around the country. It also appeared to have strong sales and marketing teams that would complement the talented engineers at Zip2. The merger had been announced in the press and seemed inevitable. The opinions on what happened next vary greatly. The logistics of the situation required the two companies to go over each other's books and to figure out which employees would be fired to avoid a duplication of roles. This process raised some questions about how frank CitySearch had been with its financials and rankled some executives at Zip2, who could see their positions being diminished or erased altogether at the new company. One faction inside Zip2 argued that the deal should be abandoned, while Sorkin demanded that it go through. Musk, who had been an early advocate of the deal, turned against it. In May 1998, the two companies canceled the merger, and the press pounced, making a big deal of the chaotic bust-up. Musk urged Zip2's board to oust Sorkin and to reinstate him as CEO of Zip2. The board declined. Instead, Musk lost his chairman title, and Sorkin was replaced by Derek Prudian, a venture capitalist with Moore Davidow. Sorkin considered Musk's behavior through the whole affair atrocious, and later pointed to the board's reaction and Musk's demotion as evidence that they felt the same way. "There was a lot of backlash and finger-pointing," Prudian said. "Elon wanted to be CEO, but I said, 'This is your first company. Let's find an acquirer and make some money so you can do your second, third, and fourth company.'" With the deal busted, Zip2 found itself in a predicament. It was losing money. Musk still wanted to go the consumer route, but Prudian feared that would take too much capital. Microsoft had mounted a charge into the same market, and startups with mapping, real estate, and automotive ideas multiplied. The Zip2 engineers were deflated and worried that they might not be able to outrun the competition. Then, in February 1999, the PC maker Compaq Computer suddenly offered to pay $307 million in cash for Zip2. "It was like pennies from heaven," said Ed Ho, a former Zip2 executive. Zip2's board accepted the offer, and the company rented out a restaurant in Palo Alto and threw a huge party. Moore Davidow had made back 20 times its original investment, and Musk and Kimball had come away with $22 million and $15 million, respectively. Musk never entertained the idea of sticking around at Compaq. As soon as it was clear the company would be sold, Elon was on to his next project, Prudian said. From that point on, Musk would fight to maintain control of his companies and stay CEO. "We were overwhelmed and just thought these guys must know what they're doing," Kimball said. "But they didn't. There was no vision once they took over. They were investors, and we got on well with them, but the vision had just disappeared from the company." Years later,
after he had time to reflect on the Zip 2 situation. Musk realized that he could have handled some of the situations with employees better.
"I had never really run a team of any sort before," Musk said. "I'd never been a sports captain or a captain of anything or managed a single person. I had to think, okay, what are the things that affect how a team functions? The first obvious assumption would be that other people will behave like you. But that's not true. Even if they would like to behave like you, they don't necessarily have all the assumptions or information that you have in your mind. So if I know a certain set of things, and I talk to a replica of myself, but only communicate half the information, you can't expect that the replica would come to the same conclusion. You have to put yourself in a position where you say, well, how would this sound to them, knowing what they know?
Employees at Zip 2 would go home at night, come back, and find that Musk had changed their work without talking to them. And Musk's confrontational style did more harm than good. "Yeah, we had some very good software engineers at Zip 2, but I mean, I could code way better than them, and I just go in and fix their fucking code," Musk said. "I would be frustrated waiting for their stuff. So I'm going to go and fix your code, and now it runs 5 times faster, you idiot." There was one guy who wrote a quantum mechanics equation, a quantum probability, on the board, and he got it wrong. I'm like, "How can you write that?" Then I corrected it for him. He hated me after that. Eventually I realized, okay, I might have fixed that thing, but now I've made the person unproductive. It just wasn't a good way to go about things. Musk, the dot-com striver, had been both lucky and good. He had a decent idea, turned it into a real service, and came out of the dot-com tumult with cash in his pockets, which was better than what many of his compatriots could say. The process had been painful. Musk had yearned to be a leader, but the people around him struggled to see how Musk as the CEO could work. As far as Musk was concerned, they were all wrong, and he set out to prove his point with what would end up being even more dramatic results.
Chapter 5. PayPal Mafia Boss. The sale of Zip 2 infused Elon Musk with a new brand of confidence. Much like the video game characters he adored, Musk had leveled up. He had solved Silicon Valley and become what everyone at the time wanted to be, a dot-com millionaire. His next venture would need to live up to his rapidly inflating ambition. This left Musk searching for an industry that had tons of money and inefficiencies that he and the Internet could exploit. Musk began thinking back to his time as an intern at the Bank of Nova Scotia. His big takeaway from that job, that bankers are rich and dumb, now had the feel of a massive opportunity. During his time working for the head of strategy at the bank in the early 1990s, Musk had been asked to take a look at the company's third-world debt portfolio. This pool of money went by the depressing name of less developed country debt, and Bank of Nova Scotia had billions of dollars of it. Countries throughout South America and elsewhere had defaulted in the years prior, forcing the bank to write down some of its debt value. Musk's boss wanted him to dig into the bank's holdings as a learning experiment and try to determine how much the debt was actually worth. While pursuing this project, Musk stumbled upon what seemed like an obvious business opportunity. The United States had tried to help reduce the debt burden of a number of developing countries through so-called Brady Bonds, in which the U.S. government basically backstopped the debt of countries like Brazil and Argentina. Musk noticed an arbitrage play. "I calculated the backstop value, and it was something like 50 cents on the dollar, while the actual debt was trading at 25 cents, Musk said. "This was like the biggest opportunity ever, and nobody seemed to realize it." Musk tried to remain cool and calm as he rang Goldman Sachs, one of the main traders in this market, and probed around about what he had seen.
He inquired as to how much Brazilian debt might be available at the 25 cents price. The guy said, "How much do you want?" And I came up with some ridiculous number, like $10 billion, Musk said. When the trader confirmed that was doable, Musk hung up the phone. I was thinking that they had to be fucking crazy, because you could double your money. Everything was backed by Uncle Sam. It was a no-brainer. Musk had spent the summer earning about $14 an hour and getting chewed out for using the executive coffee machine, among other status infractions, and figured his moment to shine and make a big bonus had arrived. He sprinted up to his boss's office and pitched the opportunity of a lifetime. "You can make billions of dollars for free," he said. His boss told Musk to write up a report, which soon got passed up to the bank's CEO, who promptly rejected the proposal, saying the bank had been burned on Brazilian and Argentinian debt before and didn't want to mess with it again. "I tried to tell them that's not the point," Musk said. "The point is that it's fucking backed by Uncle Sam. It doesn't matter what the South Americans do. You cannot lose unless you think the U.S. Treasury is going to default." But they still didn't do it, and I was stunned. Later in life, as I competed against the banks, I would think back to this moment, and it gave me confidence. All the bankers did was copy what everyone else did. If everyone else ran off a bloody cliff, they'd run right off a cliff with them. If there was a giant pile of gold sitting in the middle of the room and nobody was picking it up, they wouldn't pick it up either. In the years that followed, Musk considered starting an internet bank and discussed it openly during his internship at Pinnacle Research in 1995. The youthful Musk lectured the scientists about the inevitable transition coming in finance toward online systems, but they tried to talk him down, saying that it would take ages for web security to be good enough to win over consumers. Musk, though, remained convinced that the finance industry could do with a major upgrade, and that he could have a big influence on banking with a relatively small investment. "Money is low bandwidth," he said, during a speech at Stanford University in 2003 to describe his thinking. "You don't need some sort of big infrastructure improvement to do things with it. It's really just an entry in a database." The actual plan that Musk concocted was beyond grandiose. As the researchers at Pinnacle had pointed out, people were barely comfortable buying books online. They might take their chances entering a credit card number, but exposing just their bank accounts to the web was out of the question to many. Pa, so what? Musk wanted to build a full-service financial institution online, a company that would have savings and checking accounts, as well as brokerage services and insurance. The technology to build such a service was possible, but navigating the regulatory hell of creating an online bank from scratch looked like an intractable problem to optimists and an impossibility to more level heads. This was not dishing out directions to a pizzeria or putting up a house listing. It was dealing with people's finances, and there would be real repercussions if the service did not work as billed. Undaunted, Musk kicked this new plan into action before Zip 2 had even been sold. He chatted up some of the best engineers at the company to get a feel for who might be willing to join him in another venture. Musk also bounced his ideas off some contacts he'd made at the bank in Canada. In January 1999, with Zip 2's board seeking a buyer, Musk began to formalize his banking plan. The deal with Compaq was announced the next month, and in March, Musk incorporated X.com, a finance startup with a pornographic-sounding name. It had taken Musk less than a decade to go from being a Canadian backpacker to becoming a multimillionaire at the age of 27. With his $22 million, he moved from sharing an apartment with three roommates to buying an 1,800-square-foot condo and renovating it. He also bought a $1 million McLaren F1 sports car and a small prop plane and learned to fly. Musk embraced the newfound celebrity that he'd earned as part of the dot-com millionaire set. He let CNN show up at his apartment at 7 a.m. to film the delivery of the car. A black 18-wheeler pulled up in front of Musk's place and then lowered the sleek silver vehicle onto the street, while Musk stood slack-jawed with his arms folded. "There are 62 McLarens in the world, and I will own one of them," he told CNN. "Wow, I can't believe it's actually here. That's pretty wild, man." CNN interspersed video of the car delivery with interviews with Musk. The whole time, he looked like a caricature of an engineer who had made it big. Musk's hair had started thinning, and he had a closely cropped cut that accentuated his boyish face. He wore an all-too-big brown sport coat and checked his cell phone from his lavish car, sitting next to his gorgeous girlfriend, Justine, and he seemed spellbound by his life. Musk rolled out one laughable rich guy line after another, talking first about the Zip 2 deal. "Receiving cash is cash. I mean, those are just a large number of Ben Franklins." Next, about the awesomeness of his life. "There it is, gentlemen, the fastest car in the world." And then about his prodigious ambition. "I could go and buy one of the islands in the Bahamas and turn it into my personal fiefdom, but I'm much more interested in trying to build and create a new company." The camera crew followed Musk to the X.com offices, where his cocksure delivery led to another round of cringeworthy statements. "I do not fit the picture of a banker. Raising $50 million is a matter of making a series of phone calls, and the money is there. I think X.com could absolutely be a multi-billion dollar bonanza." Musk purchased the McLaren from a seller in Florida, snatching the car away from Ralph Lauren, who had also inquired about buying it. Even very wealthy people like Lauren would tend to reserve something like a McLaren for special events or the occasional Sunday drive. Not Musk. He drove it all around Silicon Valley and parked it on the street by the X.com offices. His friends were horrified to see such a work of art covered with bird droppings or in the parking lot of a Safeway. One day, Musk emailed fellow McLaren owner Larry Ellison, the billionaire co-founder of the software maker Oracle, out of the blue, to see if he wanted to go race cars around a track for fun. Jim Clark, another billionaire who liked fast things, caught wind of the proposal and told a friend that he needed to rush over to the local Ferrari dealership to buy something that could compete. Musk had joined the big boys' club. "Elon was super excited about all of this," said George Zachary, a venture capitalist and close friend of Musk's. "He showed me the correspondence with Larry." The next year, while driving down Sand Hill Road to meet with an investor, Musk turned to a friend in the car and said, "Watch this." He floored the car, did a lane change, spun out, and hit an embankment, which started the car spinning in midair like a frisbee. The windows and wheels were blown to smithereens, and the body of the car damaged. Musk again turned to his companion and said, "The funny part is it wasn't insured." The two of them then thumbed a ride to the venture capitalist's office. To his credit, Musk did not fully buy into this playboy persona. He actually plowed the majority of the money he made from Zip 2 into X.com. There were practical reasons for this decision. Investors catch a break under the tax law if they roll a windfall into a new venture within a couple of months. But even by Silicon Valley's high-risk standards, it was shocking to put so much of one's newfound wealth into something as iffy as an online bank. All told, Musk invested about $12 million into X.com, leaving him, after taxes, with $4 million or so for personal use. "That's part of what separates Elon from mere mortals," said Ed Ho, the former Zip 2 executive, who went on to co-found X.com. "He's willing to take an insane amount of personal risk. When you do a deal like that, it either pays off or you end up in a bus shelter somewhere." Musk's decision to invest so much money in X.com looks even more unusual in hindsight. Much of the point of being a dot-com success in 1999 was to prove oneself once, stash away your millions, and then use your credentials to talk other people into betting their money on your next venture. Musk would certainly go on to rely on outside investors, but he put major skin in the game as well. So while Musk could be found on television talking like the rest of the self-absorbed dot-com schmucks, he behaved more like a throwback to Silicon Valley's earlier days, when the founders of companies like Intel were willing to take huge gambles on themselves. Where Zip2 had been a neat, useful idea, X.com held the promise of fomenting a major revolution. Musk, for the first time, would be confronting a deep-pocketed, entrenched industry head-on, with the hopes of upending all of the incumbents. Musk also began to hone his trademark style of entering an ultra-complex business and not letting the fact that he knew very little about the industry's nuances bother him in the slightest. He had an inkling that the bankers were doing finance all wrong, and that he could run the business better than everyone else. Musk's ego and confidence had started heading him toward the levels that would inspire some and leave others thinking of him as pompous and unscrupulous. The creation of X.com would ultimately reveal a great deal about Musk's creativity, relentless drive, confrontational style, and foibles as a leader. Musk would also get another taste of being pushed aside at his own company, and the pain that accompanies a grand vision left unfulfilled. Musk assembled what looked like an all-star crew to start X.com. Ho had worked at SGI and Zip2 as an engineer, and his peers marveled at his coding and team management skills. They were joined by a pair of Canadians with finance experience, Harris Fricker and Christopher Payne. Musk had met Fricker during his time as an intern at the Bank of Nova Scotia, and the two really hit it off. A Rhodes Scholar, Fricker brought the knowledge of the banking world's mechanics that X.com would need. Payne was Fricker's friend from the Canadian finance community. All four men were considered co-founders of the company, while Musk emerged as the largest shareholder, thanks to his hefty upfront investment. X.com began, like so many Silicon Valley operations, at a house where the co-founders began brainstorming, and then moved to more formal offices at 394 University Avenue in Palo Alto. The co-founders were aligned philosophically around the idea that the banking industry had fallen behind the times. Visiting a branch bank to speak with a teller seemed pretty archaic now that the internet had arrived. The rhetoric sounded good, and the four men were enthused. The only thing stopping them was reality. Musk had a modicum of banking experience and had resorted to buying a book on the industry to help understand its inner workings. The more the co-founders thought about their plan of attack, the more they realized the regulatory issues blocking the creation of an online bank were insurmountable. As 4 and 5 months went by, the onion just kept unwrapping, said Ho. At one point, the founders thought the easiest way to solve their problems would just be to buy a bank and revamp it. While that didn't happen, they did snag a high-profile controller from Bank of America, who in turn explained, in painful detail, the complexities of sourcing loans, transferring money, and protecting accounts. From the outset, there were personality clashes as well. Musk had become a budding superstar in Silicon Valley and had the press fawning over him. This didn't sit well with Fricker, who'd moved from Canada and pegged X.com as his chance to make a mark on the world as a banking whiz. Fricker, according to numerous people, wanted to run X.com and do so in a more conventional manner. He found Musk's visionary statements to the press about rethinking the entire banking industry silly, since the company was struggling to build much of anything. "We were out promising the sun, moon, and the stars to the media," Fricker said. Elon would say that this is not a normal business environment, and you have to suspend normal business thinking. He said, "There is a happy gas factory up on the hill, and it's pumping stuff into the valley." Fricker would not be the last person to accuse Musk of overhyping products and playing the public. Although whether this is a flaw or one of Musk's great talents as a businessman is up for debate. The squabble between Fricker and Musk came to a quick, nasty end. Just 5 months after X.com had started, Fricker initiated a coup. He said either he takes over as CEO, or he's just going to take everyone from the company and create his own company, Musk said. "I don't do well with blackmail." I said, "You should go do that." So he did. Musk tried to talk Ho and some of the other key engineers into staying, but they sided with Fricker and left. Musk ended up with a shell of a company and a handful of loyal employees. "After all that went down, I remember sitting with Elon in his office," said Julie Ankenbrandt, an early X.com employee who stayed. "There were a million laws in place to block something like X.com from happening, but Elon didn't care. He just looked at me and said, 'I guess we should hire some more people.'" Fricker disputed that he yearned to be CEO, saying instead that the other employees had encouraged him to take over because of Musk's struggles getting the business off the ground. Fricker and Musk, once close friends, remain unimpressed with each other. Elon has his own code of ethics and honor and plays the game extraordinarily hard, Fricker said. When it comes down to it, for him, business is war. According to Musk, "Harris is very smart, but I don't think he has a good heart. He had a really intense desire to be running the show, and he wanted to take the company in ridiculous directions." Fricker went on to have a very successful career as CEO of GMP Capital, a Canadian financial services company. Payne founded a private equity firm in Toronto. Musk had been trying to raise funding for X.com and had to go to venture capitalists and confess that there wasn't much in the way of a company left. Mike Moritz, a famed investor from Sequoia Capital, backed the company nonetheless, making a bet on Musk and little else. Musk hit the streets of Silicon Valley once again and managed to attract engineers with his rah-rah speeches about the future of internet banking. Scott Anderson, a young computer scientist, started on August 1, 1999, just a few days after the exodus, and bought right into the vision. "You look back and it was total insanity," Anderson said. "We had what amounted to a Hollywood movie set of a website. It barely got past the VCs." Week by week, more engineers arrived, and the vision became more real. The company secured a banking license and a mutual fund license and formed a partnership with Barclays. By November, X.com's small software team had created one of the world's first online banks, complete with FDIC insurance to back the bank accounts, and three mutual funds for investors to choose. Musk gave the engineers $100,000 of his own money to conduct their testing. On the night before Thanksgiving in 1999, X.com went live to the public. "I was there until 2 a.m., Anderson said. "Then I went home to cook Thanksgiving dinner. Elon called me a few hours later and asked me to come into the office to relieve some of the other engineers. Elon stayed there 48 straight hours, making sure things worked." Under Musk's direction, X.com tried out some radical banking concepts. Customers received a $20 cash card just for signing up to use the service, and a $10 card for every person they referred. Musk did away with niggling fees and overdraft penalties. In a very modern twist, X.com also built a person-to-person payment system in which you could send someone money just by plugging their email address into the site. The whole idea was to shift away from slow-moving banks with their mainframes taking days to process payments and create a kind of agile bank account where you could move money around with a couple of clicks on a mouse or an email. This was revolutionary stuff, and more than 200,000 people bought into it and signed up for X.com within the first couple of months.